This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Tree Lin. In 1967, Israel captured the West Bank as well as the Gaza Strip and began building settlements which were declared illegal by the UN Security Council. Over time, Israeli forces consolidated restrictions around the Gaza Strip, revoking Palestinians of their right to freedom of movement and violating other human rights. The Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, or the BDS movement, arose out of Palestinian civil society 10 years ago to exert pressure on Israel to end its occupation of Palestinian land. Here in the studio with me are three leaders in the BDS movement, Anna Baltzer, Ali Hassan Abunima and Sama Sabawi, and they're here to talk about the successes, pitfalls and complexities of this global campaign. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Most of us, I think, will be aware to some measure of the human rights violations in the West Bank and Gaza. But for those who are still unclear, could you help shed some light on the current conditions in these areas?
Well, the reality is that if you're Palestinian anywhere in what is today Israel, the West Bank and Gaza, you face numerous forms of violence by the Israeli state. The most extreme is in Gaza, but even Palestinians who live in Israel and have citizenship face something like 50 laws that discriminate against them because they're not Jewish, and that's the Israeli state claims to be a Jewish state. Certainly the most catastrophic situations are in the West Bank and Gaza. Really what it comes down to is that Palestinians are struggling to stay on their land, and every single day they're facing home demolitions, bulldozers, Israeli settlers taking their land. And the real crisis and emergency is that the rest of the world is letting it go on and on. We see absolutely no action to stop it. Maybe Samah can say something more about Gaza, because it's really the most extreme crisis.
It is, absolutely. The UN was warning last week that Gaza will become uninhabitable in 5 years. And a lot of people in Gaza reacted to this by saying, in 5 years, it has been uninhabitable for quite some time. The unemployment rate in Gaza is at 44%. The horrible attack Israel wrought on the city last year in 2014 destroyed more than two-thirds of the city. A lot of the infrastructure was gone with that. 500,000 Palestinians became displaced. 100,000 of them continue to be displaced today. None of the homes that were destroyed has been rebuilt. No construction material has been allowed in since then. And I'm always aware of the calls during the attacks on Gaza last year by the Palestinians, who were saying, we don't want a ceasefire with Israel if a ceasefire means we continue to die slowly. Either kill us quickly or bring us a solution that will see an end to the oppression that we suffer. And unfortunately, their cries have not been heard yet.
It's from this atmosphere that the BDS movement sprung up. Could you tell us what exactly it is and how it arose?
So as Ali was saying, the reason Israel is able to continue its oppression of the Palestinian people is because of the complicity and participation of the international community. So what the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, sanctions, BDS, asks of us really is a basic moral obligation, that people around the world need to look at the ways in which we ourselves are implicated. We are involved in Israel's oppression of Palestinians in various ways, and we can talk about some specifics, and we need to work to end that complicity as a form of solidarity with Palestinians and of holding Israel accountable. And BDS has been extremely effective, actually, in both of these ways. The Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, sanctions was made 10 years ago and is based on three rights. This is the goals of the BDS movement, addressing the different parts of Palestinian society. And those rights are an end to the occupation that you spoke of beginning in 1967, but also equality for Palestinians inside what is today Israel, an end to discriminatory laws that privilege Jews, and of course the right of return for Palestinian refugees who are living in exile today. And so these three rights are enshrined in the BDS call, and that's been a lot of its power internationally, is that it is not based on a particular religion or a particular political party or a particular resolution, but it says that for there to be any lasting resolution in Palestine, we must see all of these rights realized. We need freedom, justice, and equality for the Palestinian people.
Can I just jump in there? Because, you know, also it's worth mentioning that this tactic of boycott, divestment, and sanctions has such a long history in freedom struggles around the world, certainly in the United States and in many parts of the world, but particularly in South Africa. And many people will remember the role of boycott, divestment, and sanctions in helping to end apartheid in South Africa. And what's really been a great boost for the morale of Palestinians is the support that has come from really key leaders in the South African liberation struggle, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu and others, who've even gone as far as saying that what Palestinians are facing today is worse than what black people experienced in apartheid South Africa.
While we're doing that comparison with apartheid, you know, unlike the apartheid, the nature of this war is a cause of some debate. To what extent is this war one of land, and how much is it to do with religion?
This is such a key question, because the people who want to keep things as they are put forward this narrative where they try to create a false equivalence between the Palestinians and Israelis, and they, you know, they say things like, oh, it's an ancient squabble that goes back hundreds of years or thousands of years. That's absolutely not true. Or they try to say that it's a religious conflict. Well, you know, a religious conflict has no solution. You know, until we all die and find out who was right and who was wrong. And we shouldn't have to wait for that. We want justice in our time on this planet. So there are specific reasons why people put forward the fiction that this is a religious conflict or something very complicated. It's really quite simple. People understand it. Palestinians are being deprived of their land, of their rights, of their water, and they're fighting to stay on their land and to win back their rights. And, you know, it took ending oppression and apartheid in Ireland, in so many places around the world, to bring peace. And Palestinians want peace, but you cannot have peace without justice.
This movement emerged after intervention and peacemaking efforts proved ineffective. I mean, when we talk about rights, when we talk about, you know, trying to achieve some measure of justice or just of livability, I think it stands to reason that that should be a simple enough thing to do. But why has Israel been able to skirt international humanitarian laws thus far?
I think that the peace process was never really designed to bring an end or a peaceful resolution to the conflict. The peace process was designed from the beginning to give Israel the time that it needs to continue to expand and to build settlements. There were no mechanisms put in place within the Oslo agreements that guaranteed that Israel would comply with the simplest act of not expanding on Palestinian land. That was still up to negotiations during the peace process. And I'm sure Ali has a lot more to say about the peace process. But I just want to say what the BDS has done is it has created, really has given us a very different kind of hope, and it opened up our eyes to something that's really important. Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority were telling us repeatedly that politics was the art of what is possible, and so we have to look at what Israel can possibly give to us and then work from there to achieve our needs and to fulfill our aspirations. And what the BDS has done and what really good human rights and civil rights movements do is they open your mind to the fact that human rights is not concerned with the art of the possibility. It is concerned with what is moral and with what is just. And so we will continue to ask for what is moral and for what is just, and for the full array of human rights for the Palestinian people. But I'm sure you've got a lot to say about the Palestinian Authority.
You know, look, I try to use a very simple example about the peace process. It makes it much easier to explain. Instead of talking about all these complicated issues of land and politics and all of this, just think about a pizza. If you and I are negotiating over how to slice a pizza, and while we're negotiating, I start gobbling the pizza as fast as I can, then, you know, it doesn't take a genius to see that that is a sham and there is no negotiations there. And that's exactly what Israel has been doing for more than 20 years. While Palestinians have said, okay, we'll negotiate, Israel has been taking more of their land, destroying tens of thousands of their productive trees, not just their trees, but with their trees, their customs, their tradition, their culture is being destroyed and bulldozed by Israel under the cover of a so-called peace process. That's why the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, says, we would love to negotiate with the Palestinians. Come and talk to us. Of course, it costs them nothing when there are no consequences and no accountability. Look around the world. There are dozens of countries that are under various forms of sanctions by the United Nations Security Council or by the European Union or by the United States or goodness knows who. Now, you can go to the UN. In fact, you don't need to go that far. And you find stacks of reports, stacks of resolutions saying Israel has been violating international law for decades. There has never once been any serious international effort to hold Israel to account. And that's why Palestinians are saying now, we're calling directly, we're going over the heads of the UN, over the heads of government, directly to people and civil society and saying, help us, support us with boycott, divestment, and sanctions as you did with South Africa.
That support and the complicity that we mentioned earlier are two aspects that I'd like to explore after this. I'm speaking today with Anna Baltzer, Ali Hassan Abunima, and Sama Sabawi about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. My guests today are Anna Baltzer, Ali Hassan Abunima, and Sama Sabawi. We are discussing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And earlier, you mentioned complicity. How exactly do boycotts, divestments, and sanctions work?
So building off what Ali was saying about the international complicity that allows Israel's oppression of Palestinians to continue and the way that BDS actually fills this gap and allows us to directly challenge Israel's oppression, we've actually seen the way in which BDS campaigns, and I'll give some examples as you asked, have truly become what Israel considers its greatest strategic threat. And that just shows how powerful BDS is and how important it could be for Malaysia to play a strong role in this movement. And that's why we're so excited to be here in Malaysia to talk about it. Israel itself talks about the tens of billions of dollars that that it is losing, companies refusing to buy into contracts with Israel. We've achieved in 10 years what it took decades to achieve in the anti-apartheid movement challenging apartheid South Africa. We can point to specific corporate targets that are now leaving, ending their contracts with Israel. We see the ways in which for years we were waiting. We were waiting for our politicians to do something else. We were waiting for Israel to change, and we are now going over the heads, as Ali was saying, of these institutions to really force that change, to move from sympathy into real action in the form of campaigns. And just in the few days that I've been here in Malaysia, it's been incredible to see the popular support for Palestinians here on the ground. And this is, I cannot think of a more effective place that a campaign could take shape that really holds, for example, a corporation accountable for its involvement in apartheid Israel. So, for example, there are companies such as Hyundai, Hewlett-Packard, G4S. These are companies that are intimately involved in Israeli occupation and apartheid. Even though Malaysia does not have formal diplomatic ties with Israel, Malaysia does have contracts with these companies. These companies are all around us here in Malaysia. What would it look like to hold those companies accountable here in the Malaysian context? Hyundai, for example, demolishes Palestinian homes, provides bulldozers that were used to destroy Gaza, as we heard about before. How can you simultaneously be supporting Palestinians and yet supporting a corporation that's destroying Palestine. So you know, in the way that Malaysia is actively participating in humanitarian efforts, which are so important to sustain the Palestinian population that is living under such dire conditions, just as we work to help rebuild Palestinians' homes, so must we also challenge the corporations and the institutions, including Israel and companies like Hyundai, that are demolishing those homes and put an end to those structures of violence that are really the obstacle to peace. So humanitarian efforts really, it must be coupled with campaigns that really challenge those structures. Another really interesting campaign that people here might look at is divestment. So, for example, are there funds that are invested in corporations like the ones I named, like Caterpillar and other international companies? Divesting funds, removing investments from these companies can send a very powerful message to Israel. Another one that I'll mention is Malaysia is now on the Security Council of the United Nations, which is an incredible place for Malaysia to be able to exert some pressure here. And there's a new campaign calling on the UN to end its contracts with G4S, which provides prison services for Israel to be able to torture Palestinian political prisoners. What would it look like to challenge those contracts? So, you know, we're really excited to be at this conference this Saturday to think concretely about what a campaign could look like in this context, because I've never seen a country more that could have a more powerful impact on all of Asia. So we're really excited to think concretely about it and to look at what it would look like to pick a strategic target based on the context here.
Based on the few days that you've been here, and I mean, I guess speaking broadly, because the whole idea of boycott, divestment, and sanctions, I think it relies in great part on knowledge among the general populace, of people understanding the role that corporations play, of people understanding business partnerships and so on. How would you say Malaysians fare in that area? You know, is there an understanding of the kinds of cooperations our country has with corporations that could be supporting Israel?
I think Malaysians are the same as any other people. We do have to do a little bit of raising awareness on the ground and making those direct links between the corporations that are complicit and have direct links with Israeli violations. So that's an important part of any campaign that can take ground here in Malaysia.
Go ahead.
Well, what I wanted to say is that you know, in Malaysia, there is tremendous sympathy and concern for what's happening in Palestine. And that's an incredible starting point. And I think what, you know, many people here in Malaysia and around the world, they feel frustrated by the fact that they see what's going on in Palestine. They see the inaction of the so-called international community. And they ask themselves, what can I do to make a difference? And so the importance of really coming up with well-designed campaigns where people can really participate and feel that they're having a difference, that they are pressuring these corporations into complicit in Israeli crimes, pressuring the Malaysian government or other governments to do more. You know, Malaysia doesn't have diplomatic relations with Israel, but Malaysia is a member of many international organizations, everything from sporting and academic to various international organizations, where it can also use its clout to help to hold Israel accountable. So I think partly it's getting people to understand the potential and the power that they have and that Malaysia has, and that Malaysia can also be a leader in this area, because think about, you know, if Indonesia follows suit or Thailand or other countries in the region, and already I think Malaysia is well ahead of them.
Could you give us some examples of how sanctions, whether military, economic or diplomatic, have been enforced on Israel?
Well, there aren't many examples of sanctions, because sanctions are usually at the state level. But what we're seeing in the European Union now is a very slow and gradual move towards sanctions, or at least some state-level accountability. So, for example, the European Union has said that they're on the verge of agreeing to a policy where goods produced in Israeli settlements against international law would be labeled. Now, the response from Palestinians overwhelmingly is that is far too little. Those settlement goods should be banned. But that this has happened at all is a sign of the pressure European leaders are under to do much, much more. And I think that they will be pushed in that direction. The other thing is that we have seen overwhelming calls from hundreds of European civil society organizations, trade unions, and others to impose a two-way arms embargo on Israel. No buying or selling weapons to Israel. And this has been echoed by hundreds of lawmakers in the European Parliament and national parliaments around Europe. So we're not yet at the stage of major state-level sanctions being imposed, but we are there, getting there. And the key thing is to realize that we've only come this far because of grassroots pressure from below.
And there's a reason it goes BDNS. We know that the boycott and divestment campaigns will naturally help us build power to finally impose sanctions.
By the way, one other thing. I mean, it's not just national governments. If you take a company like Veolia, a major infrastructure company, it lost billions of euros of contracts because city governments in Europe were refusing to give them contracts because of their complicity in the occupation. And that was, again, because of pressure from their citizens. So sanctions can also be at a city level as well.
And the Veolia thing ended up in a great success.
Absolutely.
Recently.
They pulled out completely from Israel.
Yeah.
BDS began initially internally with support and endorsement from Palestinian civil society. How did that scale up to its international support? What was that process?
Well, I mean, for me, one of the most important aspects of BDS is that it comes from Palestinian civil society. And I don't know the Malaysian context well enough, but certainly in the United States, there's a history of non-Palestinians wanting to solve this for Palestinians. And the power of BDS is that it centers Palestinians back as our place of accountability, that this is what the people themselves are asking of us. And it is a moral obligation that we support this non-violent, powerful, effective mode of campaigning.
It also gives the people in the solidarity movements internationally something to do for Palestine. It empowers people who are not necessarily under occupation and able to march against the wall in Bilayin or to support the resistance on the ground. It's a call out to the rest of the world, and it's a call that is very appealing, and the appeal continues to grow.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's an incredible, international, beautiful, growing movement, and that's why it's so exciting to be here in Malaysia and speaking on Saturday at the BDS for Justice conference, where we'll be able to speak in more depth about these different things. It's at the University of Malaya on Saturday, September 12th, from 8 to 5, put on by Viva Palestina. So we're hoping to get more into what BDS could mean for Malaysia, and I invite everyone out there to join us.
Samar, you've previously written that many tend to paint BDS advocates as anti-Semitic or radical. How has the movement addressed these portrayals?
I think the movement sets an example by showing, I mean, the diversity within the movement itself is quite incredible. We have a lot of Jewish activists within the BDS movements. We are calling for equality and for justice and for freedom. And these are demands that are basic human rights demands that appeal to everybody. What we reject is the idea that one group of people should have privilege above the others, and in this case, that the Jewish people should have privilege above the Palestinian people in Palestine. So I think we address it by really showing by example and leading by example within the movement.
And it's also very important to affirm that the BDS movement targets complicity, it targets institutions, it doesn't target individuals, and it certainly doesn't target Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really important, that we are fighting for equal rights for all people, and this is a fundamentally anti-racist movement as well. For us, that's fundamental. For us as Palestinians, the experience of Zionism, the experience of Israeli conquest has been one of racist violence against us. We don't want to reproduce that. We want to end it.
It is, of course, unfortunate that because of the nature of the conflict and because of how it's presented, because of how long running it's been, there are going to be people, I suppose, within the movement who might have different agendas. I mean, how do you cope with that within a movement that has a sort of larger overriding objective and one that nobody would disagree with, but might have, I guess, fringe elements within?
Well, by being very clear about our principles, and on the occasions where someone has claimed, to be in solidarity with Palestinians, but has used that platform to express any sort of racist sentiment, you will find no shortage of Palestinians, including myself and Samah and others, who've been very public in saying, "You don't speak for us." Mm. We reject any form of discrimination based on race, religion. That is the fundamental of our movement, the fundamental principle of our movement. So we do it by being very, very clear about our principles and always putting in the forefront that we are fighting against a system of oppression, a system of colonization, and beyond it, we see the hope for people living in equality, regardless of their religion, race, ethnicity, or origin.
Is there a risk that a movement like this could further entrench the divide between Israelis and Palestinians?
We've heard this argument come from right-wing Israeli Zionists, and I think that hasn't proven itself to be true. I don't think it's caused any divide. I think, if anything, as we move forward within this movement, we are growing in solidarity and we are growing in numbers. And we are learning from each other. And the conversation is opening up. So my short answer is no. I don't know if anybody wants to add to this.
Well, I mean, I'm going to be very frank about this. How could a movement that is based on nonviolent tactics calling for equality be divisive, whereas Israeli war crimes, the destruction of Gaza, the demolition of thousands of homes, the construction of a system of apartheid is somehow not divisive? I mean, many times the people, you have to look at who's also saying these things. The people who are saying that BDS is divisive or people struggling for Palestinian rights are divisive are often the people who defend the status quo, who defend the injustice. And what you find is that those who are very happy with the situation, who are sitting in seats of power, are the ones who say that those are critical, who are critical, are those who are fighting for change, are somehow disruptive and divisive. Why aren't the ones who are implementing all these oppressive policies the divisive ones?
Moving forward, looking at the BDS movement and just overall, what are your hopes for the future of Palestine?
Do you want to start?
Well, I defer to the Palestinians in the room.
Well, that Palestinians should be able to live freely in their land, that those who have been exiled just because they're not Jewish should be able to return, that the families who have been divided for generations by walls, by fences, by wars should be able to reunite in their country, that children in Gaza should not grow up only with memories of war and destruction, and that really just the basic hopes. I mean, you look around, you look around this country, you look around the other countries we've been, and people are able to, hope for a better life, to try to work. Palestinians can't do that right now, and they just want to have that same hope as other people in the world.
And BDS, what BDS gives us is this gift of being able to contribute to that vision, that no matter who you are anywhere in the world, we can participate in this extraordinary movement. And that's what BDS gives us, is it gives us back our power to challenge Israel, to look at our own complicity and to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians, with what they're asking of us.
Thank you all very much for coming in today. I've been speaking with Anna Baltzer, Ali Hassan Abunima, and Samah Sabawi. We have been discussing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.